little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand. Well, a very hearty welcome to a show called Thinking Clearly. It's a show about critical thinking and related topics. My name is Bob Frelick, along with co-host.
I'm Julia Minton.
Yes, she is. And we're celebrating the Independence Day.
Speak here for yourself, Bob.
That's a holiday, a national holiday. And so we kind of got the holiday spirit here.
I'm celebrating my holiday pay.
We're guestless on the Northern California coast. It's a special show, though. What makes it
special?
We're
independent.
Yes, that's right. So we've got a good show planned for you, and I'll tell you a little bit about that after Julia says something about how you can get in touch with us, how you can pop up our previously archived versions of our podcast version of the show.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you've tuned in to Thinking Clearly before, you've heard my rap that we, Bob and I, are real people, and we love to hear from you, our real listeners. You can get in touch with us by our Facebook page, Thinking Clearly Radio on KMUD. If you just put in Thinking Clearly, our Facebook page will pop up, and we answer those messages.
Pop up, is that a pun because it's Independence Day here?
Well, I suppose so.
Yeah, and you know how you know I'm a real person? I'm eating a tasty sweet right now in the studio.
We're independent today.
That's right.
You can also find Thinking Clearly podcasts. That's right. We not only archive everything on KMUD's archives, and you can stream us live at kmud.org, but you can also subscribe to our podcast that comes out within 24 hours. It is thinkingclearly.libsyn.org.
How do you spell Libsyn?
L-I-B. S-Y-N.
You got it.
It stands for Liberation Syndication.
All right.
To go with that whole Independence
Another Independence
Day.
Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got it.
Oh, boy.
Okay, yeah, because our listeners do give us ideas for future topics. We've been blessed with a number of great ideas from listeners. That's really helpful. Or they critique our show. They ask questions, ask for additional resources.
I'm so grateful for our listeners because, really, if it was just you and me, Bob, well, I'm just going to leave it there.
We just be eating sweets all night here. You know?
But we do love hearing from you. And later on in the show, we will be opening the phone line.
We will. Let me say a little about the episode. What we're going to do is cover some mini topics, and we're going to kind of introduce this as one of the alternative formats on various different episodes of Thinking Clearly, where we won't have a guest, but we'll talk about some mini topics. Sometimes we'll talk about a full topic, Julia and I, and introduce a topic and discuss it and get your comments.
And often it feels like one show isn't even enough for one topic.
Most of the time. But this is going to be an idea of testing this out as several mini topics that we're going to talk about tonight. And it's going to be a discussion of claims, conclusions, opinions, beliefs. What do those terms really mean? Some of those terms are in our definition of critical thinking, and we have talked a little bit about them, but I thought it would be a good idea to review and talk in a little more depth about what those terms mean. We're going to talk about open-mindedness and the skeptic's sniff test.
Mm.
We'll also talk about the power of knowledge, having some knowledge about probability. And if time permits, which it probably won't, we'll talk about some of the consequences of not thinking clearly or critically, either, and both.
No, there are moments. It can be a downside.
It can. And we're going to open the phone lines about 7:40 and invite you to call in with your questions about these topics, previous show topics, ideas for future shows, or just critical thinking in general. I'm going to read you our definition, and we go over this definition and a description. We have both a description of critical thinking and a definition of critical thinking. The first part is the definition, and then we throw in some additional kind of mindsets or attitudes that we feel are important to go along with critical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But let's start with the definition. It goes like this. Critical thinking is a mode of thinking that uses the process of logical reasoning based on a thorough examination and evaluation of a robust cross-section of evidence relevant to the issue at hand when forming claims, conclusions, opinions, and beliefs. What do we mean by claims, conclusions, opinions and beliefs? That's the question that we're going to bat around between Julie and I here
tonight. Often they sound very similar. They can be hard to differentiate.
They can, but it is important to have clear ideas what we mean by these terms, key words, in any kind of a discussion that we're having. Because as we've said before, sometimes people argue past each other because they don't have the same definition of some particular key word that's in the issue they're talking about. So it's really a cool thing to do is to get that groundwork laid right at the start so that you're talking a common language.
Which can mean simply asking someone to define the term that they're using, how they're using it. And you might find that you guys were having completely separate conversation. And in a way, that's part of open-mindedness, isn't it?
I think so, because language is fluid and it has different connotations to different people. So
literally has different connotations.
Almost all words do. I've been reading a little, I'm digressing now, but I've been
reading. But that's what today's for.
I've been reading a book by Steven Pinker that someone gave me, and it has a whole chapter on metaphors. You and I have talked about how do we work metaphors into critical thinking and that kind of thing. And so
I'm looking forward to that.
That made me think, because there are some people that believe that all language, almost all words in our language are metaphor. So at any rate, we're not going to get into metaphors tonight. We may use one here and there, salt them here and there. But let's take that first term. What does claims, what does that word mean to you?
Claim? Well, a claim is when you make a claim about something that's true. You say, I have oil on my property.
Okay. So it's usually a fairly simple declarative statement about something that has a truth value. It can be either true or false.
I have oil on my property.
That's all a claim is. And people are making claims all the time. I just made a claim when I said people are making claims all the time. So we're going to talk about that because that's a very powerful starting point in critical thinking. You can't underestimate the power of recognizing a claim, what a claim is, and differentiating that from a conclusion. That's what we're going to do tonight. But claims can be descriptive. There's kind of two categories, general categories for claims. They can be descriptive about the way the world is, or the way it could be. For example, I could say, on Earth, dropped objects fall to the ground. Now, fairly uncontroversial claim, right? And most of us would agree it was true.
Yeah, it seems like it would be.
All right. Another claim might be, quote, according to a New York Times analysis since 2007, at least 173 people have been killed in mass shootings involving AR-15s in the United States. Is that a claim?
That sounds like a claim.
Sure. It's a claim. It's declaring something to be true, right? And it is either true or false. We want to think about checking that claim, right? Now, I just made a quote. So you could check me on that quote, right? You could look up. You could do a internet search for some of the key words there. New York Times, AR-15s, mass shootings. Put those words into your search engine.
Oh boy, you're going to get something interesting back from that.
But you will also get that New York Times article, and you are checking my sources. So I didn't to know that I didn't make up those numbers, right? So you can do that, and I'm advocating that we do this, and we can't do it for everything we hear or see, but the things that are important to us to know the truth value of.
Yeah, and I saw a claim recently on the internet that I brought here for you today.
Oh, good.
It smells a little.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Doesn't pass the sniff test, huh?
Well, we'll see. We'll see. So here is this claim that was circulating on the internet, so it must be true. A team of four Nigerian girls have created a generator that produces 6 hours of electricity using only a single liter of urine. Oh, Bob's focusing hard.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you want me to read that again?
No.
Okay, you got it. 6 hours of electricity from a liter of urine as fuel.
Okay.
Well, that's a claim, right?
It is a claim, and it's either true or false, right? Because then you could go and you could track down these folks that created this machine and do an experiment, a controlled demonstration of that, and see if it actually lives up to that claim. Now, when we get to sniff test, let's come back to this when we get to sniff test, because I have some things that I'm thinking about as to whether that would pass my sniff test or not.
All right, so we'll come back to sniff the urine of leader producing electricity.
Oh man, when you put it that way, it doesn't sound quite as good.
I told you it smelled. But it is, it's something that was very intriguing. It's like,
it is intriguing.
And it hits you viscerally. Yes, young women in Nigeria are making electricity from renewable resources.
Yeah.
All right, I can't wait to come back to
it. And it may be true or false. It would be one that I think I would probably want to research.
It is true or false.
All right. Well, we've established something here. Okay, so we have claims, and claims have a truth value, true or false. So they can be descriptive about the way the world is, and we've given some examples of that. The other category of claims are normative claims. And normative claims use evaluative words. They're somehow associated with a value that we put as human beings put on them. And so the kind of words that are value-based words are ought, should, right, wrong, good, bad, like, dislike, right? For example, we might claim we should outlaw assault rifles. So the statement that I gave you first, that there are 173 people that have been killed by AR-15s in the United States, that's a descriptive claim. A normative claim might be the response, well, then we should outlaw assault rifles. And we talked about the difference between descriptive claims and arguments and normative claims and arguments. So,
sort of like facts and morals.
Right, right. Facts and values, or morals, or ethics, or legal issues, or aesthetics. You know, those are all issues that have to do with evaluating something and putting our values on that. So basically, now we've got really a lot of good starting power for critical thinking by being able to recognize a claim in any information that comes our way. We hear it, we read it, we recognize that claim. And then we've been able to say, is that a descriptive claim or is it a normative claim? So I'm encouraging people to practice this. It's fun. It's really gives you a sense of sort of power and objectivity in a way. It kind of puts that analytic part of your mind into play rather than just reacting emotionally to something that you hear or see.
And I think that's part of the tool of critical thinking is to try and separate that subtlety.
Right. To get to the evidence which, using logic, leads to some sort of a conclusion. So now let's talk about what a conclusion is. In our core definition, we said we're describing actually a logical argument in our core definition of critical thinking, in which the evidence is a claim or a set of claims, or in logic, you call those premises. So premises are claims, and they can be true or false, right? And those premises are intended to provide support for a new claim that we call
the conclusion.
The conclusion. So the conclusion flows from the premises logically.
You're building it. The claims build the foundation towards the conclusion.
And the tools we're using to build that conclusion are the principles of logic. So all you have to do to be a critical thinker really is to learn to spot claims, premises, know what evidence is there, and what kind of argument is being constructed. That's the probably most difficult part of critical thinking is learning the principles of logic. You do not have to be a logician or a magician or any of those things to learn just the bare bones basic principles of logic that come up in most arguments.
Yes. To further extend the metaphor of a tool, it's kind of like a hammer. Like, I know how to use a hammer. I know how to hit a nail straight. I don't know how to build a house. That's another level. So enhancing our ability, our skills in using these tools, it's not a black and white yes or no thing. We're constantly expanding our abilities.
Right. Well said. So we've got now the difference between claims, premises are the evidence, and conclusions which spring from a logical connection from our premises to our conclusions. So that's the basis, really, of critical thinking. It's the basis. It comes from philosophy, and specifically from logic. So the next thing is to realize that there are arguments that also involve normative claims, which is a little bit harder to construct because there are lots of different ways to construct a normative argument, a values-based argument, a moral or ethical argument.
Mm-hmm. But and yet we do it all the time.
We do it all the time, but most of the time, I think people construct it intuitively. They do a quick construction.
Well, sure.
If they then step back and say, but wait a minute, how would I really construct an argument? Then they have to ponder how they're going to do that. Are they going to go by some set of rules, the good book, you know, the Ten Commandments, and that tells you what's right or wrong?
Well, I think that's really interesting because I think, to me, that sounds like very much your approach and your style. Mm-hmm. I think what a lot of people do is, again, we intuitively have these, we have a moral compass. We intuitively kind of create these normative arguments, as you say. And I think a good place for some people to start is to reverse engineer that intuition that's happening. So if I feel so strongly that assault weapons should be banned, well, what is that intuition? Let's mm-hmm. deconstruct it a little bit. Let's see where I was using good logic and critical thinking, and let's see where maybe some of my premises are missing,
yeah.
and we can shore it up. You're kind of starting off on zero, though.
But I think we do both.
We do.
And in fact, when we're in discussion with other people, basically that other person is doing the reverse engineering of our argument. They're looking at how did you get from this point to this point?
Sometimes.
And it causes us to think sometimes and wonder how we actually did get from one point to another. So we've introduced this whole idea of descriptive arguments versus normative arguments, values-based arguments. And that was back in episode number 18 of Thinking Clearly. Title of that episode was Critical Thinking About Moral Issues. And also 33, we did Critical Thinking Involving Moral Issues with our guest, HSU philosophy professor Benjamin Schaefer. So you can go back and look at those. It gives you a little tip of the iceberg view of some of the difference between descriptive and normative arguments and how we reason through on those ethical, moral, normative type of arguments.
And you can find them all in our podcast.
Yes, at, we don't have to say that again. That's shameless promotion. Well, sometimes claims are presented as a matter of opinion or beliefs with no argument. So it's really important to be able to see if there is an argument, you know. So we're able to spot claims to decide whether claims are descriptive or normative, and to actually see if there are premises or evidence logically bringing us to a conclusion, which is the definition of argument. So that's a really powerful ability right there just at the start of critical thinking. But what's an opinion? You have an opinion on what an opinion is?
Oh, yeah.
What is it?
Well, it's when I'm right.
That's not the Oxford Dictionary definition.
Oh, no. My opinion is I'm always right.
That's another opinion. You got a second opinion and you got it from yourself. Okay. Well, the Oxford Dictionary definition.
Normative claim. I should always be right.
She's got it covered tonight. The Oxford Dictionary definition of opinion is a view or judgment formed about something, not necessarily based on fact or knowledge. Okay, so opinion, according to this Oxford Dictionary definition, could be based on facts, mm-hmm. could have premises. There could be really an argument involved in your opinion or not. Your opinion could just be a snap value judgment mm-hmm. that you made.
Mm-hmm.
All right, something you heard, something your parents told you. It doesn't necessarily have to be something that comes from evidence.
Every tablespoon of mayonnaise takes a year off your life.
Okay. Did you hear that in growing up?
That's my opinion.
Oh, okay. And that could be supported, but probably not.
It feels right.
I would do the skeptic sniff test on that one and go and hold my nose. But at any rate, in some contexts, opinions are evidence-based.
Mm-hmm.
A legal opinion, for example. You know, the judge doesn't just come in and say, we should deem this law unconstitutional. You know, there's a very well thought out argument, legal argument for legal opinions. Mm-hmm. So it depends on the context. So when somebody says my opinion, you don't know whether their opinion has come from an argument that they've done a lot of thinking about, or they just thought it up just then or heard it somewhere.
And I'll throw a curveball in there. There are some things that can only be opinion. For instance, I happen to think mayonnaise is really, truly disgusting. Can that be a fact?
That's just personal preference.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It seems like no matter what, it's opinion. Yes. There's no fact that mayonnaise is inherently delicious.
It's a personal preference. And it would be knowledge if I knew that about you and it were indeed true. You weren't putting me on, but you really thought it was disgusting. That would be knowledge about you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because knowledge is a whole other issue now. What is knowledge? And we may or may not get into touch that one. But now, belief. Here's the Oxford Dictionary definition of belief. An acceptance that a statement is true or that something exists. Again, that's kind of moot on whether there is a argument and evidence in a belief. To me, belief is a little stronger than opinion.
Mm. Well, I believe that mayonnaise was brought to earth by Satan.
Okay. And so there you go. You lived up to the definition. There's probably no argument that you've made to make that claim. So at any rate, we're going to hear a little bit about what belief is from some folks, but that'll come in a minute or two. So sometimes people, even those who consider themselves critical thinkers, will offer up opinions and belief prior to researching evidence. Usually they'll say something about intuitively, I guess, or I believe, or my instinct tells me. And that's a little cue that they probably haven't researched that. It's really common that that happens. So if I say, made the claim we should outlaw assault rifles, but had not really examined the evidence, then that claim would not be a conclusion of a good argument, right?
Now, what if I talked to a bunch of people who agreed with me and they had experiences of their own that, in fact, we should outlaw assault rifles? Mm-hmm. Isn't that research?
It's not research.
It'd be like anecdotal.
Could construct an argument saying that if I can find people in this community who agree with me that we should be going by contemporary community standards, you might be able to construct some sort of an argument around that, but you'd have to put some premises in there that may be questionable.
Mm. Well, I'm just thinking, you know, I'm thinking about this whole, should we outlaw assault rifles? So I went and I talked to my neighbor, and he told me what he thought about assault rifles and how they use them in the military and their experiences. And it confirmed what I had already thought before going to talk to them. Mm-hmm. So isn't that just aren't I collecting evidence?
Well, you are doing what we've talked about before, which is called confirmation bias, because you didn't do a robust search, as our definition says, for evidence.
But this is my neighbor and I trust them. And, you know, they told me what they thought. And I mean, it jived with what I thought. So, you know.
Well, I'm not saying that's uncommon. I would just say that that's probably not falling in with the domain of critical thinking.
Okay.
Because you could talk to another neighbor in another county, another city, another state, another country who would have a completely different opinion. And now if you did a survey of a random survey of everybody in the United States and then had a premise in your argument that our laws should be based on what the majority of people think, you might be able to construct some sort of argument around that.
Okay. Well, that was generous. Thank you, Bob.
You're welcome. So this brings us to the idea of relevant evidence. What is relevant evidence? Some evidence is more relevant than others. If you're trying to make an argument that we should outlaw assault rifles in the U.S., and part of that argument was that you found evidence that other countries that prohibited them saw a subsequent reduction in mass murders, and that reducing mass murders is a good thing, then that would be relevant evidence. But if you came back and said that your evidence was that automobiles kill far more people than guns, that would have very little relevance to the argument that you're trying to make. So some evidence is more relevant than another. And this issue of relevance is very, very important in terms of the validity or strength of an argument and whether it's a deductive or an inductive argument. And so the idea is that all evidence is not equal and that it takes a judgment call to really verify that the evidence that you're getting is relevant.
That makes me think of correlation and causation often come up when people bring evidence into an argument. Mm-hmm. You know, you can say, well, the rate of autism's been going up at the same rate that people are buying organic vegetables. Are you going to jump to the conclusion that organic vegetables are causing autism? No, it's a correlation. They both happen to be happening at the same time. We can also say the internet usage is going up because, well, guess what? It was only invented 40 years ago and has been expanding.
You can find a multitude of things that correlated with the thing that you're trying to investigate. And that doesn't mean that those caused those things. Right. They could have been coincidentally correlated, or they could be a third thing that motivates both of them to increase or decrease and causes the correlation. So, relevance of evidence is a key skill to use in critical thinking. So anyway, we talked about topics of claims and conclusions and beliefs and attitudes, but knowledge is in there too. So one of the things that we've done a lot of on this show is to study and have guests that are researching all those ways that we introduce biases into our thought process. I mentioned one, confirmation bias. Confirmation bias is being attracted to evidence that agrees with things that we already believe and staying away from evidence that just confirms that, the things that we believe.
And it's something we all do, even critical thinkers.
Definitely. When psychologists begin to study things like belief, well, they have to be able to do an operational definition. They have to be able to know what they're studying enough and describe what they're studying enough. So it becomes very important for them to describe and define the terms. So we're going to listen to a short clip, audio clip, and this is from a really cool podcast by David McCraney, and it's called You Are Not So Smart. It's podcast number 150, and what we're going to hear is we're going to hear a couple researchers from the United States. They're both at the Grand Valley State College in Allendale, Michigan, Michael Wolff and Todd Williams, and they're interested in belief change, and that's their research, but they need to describe those terms and define those terms. So they're going to be discussing attitude, belief, and knowledge.
There are differences of opinions on some of these definitions, and so we have learned through submitting papers and quibbling with reviewers to just be clear up front about the definitions that we are using.
So the difference, so an attitude, I could have an attitude that I think that we should all have more guns, that it will make us safe. But that attitude is unnecessary. It doesn't necessarily have to be tied to fact.
Attitudes are heavily studied in social psychology, and attitudes generally refer to something that has an emotional or what they call an affective component.
And so I might understand that the statistics on the prevalence of guns indicate that the more guns that are present, the more danger I am personally of being injured by one. But my attitude is irrespective of the true state of affairs in the world.
I might think that homosexuality is genetically determined, but I may have an attitude that I wish it wasn't. I may think, you know what, I wish that people had some control over their sexual orientation, but I believe that in the actual world, people do not. So what you think is true of the world is not necessarily the same thing as how you feel about it.
Beliefs are our approximation of the true state of affairs in the world.
Beliefs in that sense would be connected to actual things in the world. I believe that the climate is changing. for example.
For instance, I believe that light switches bring light, or I believe that electricity can be used to bring light. That is rooted in evidence and needs necessarily to be connected to the state of affairs in reality.
And knowledge, then, we defined, and cognitive psychology has been in the business of studying knowledge for years, but as what we call mental representations, or kind of things that you know. So there are lots of ways that knowledge can differ from beliefs.
Knowledge is all that is stored in memory and is typically constructed of long-term memories that are formed, usually combined with emotion and other related constructs.
So I could say, for example, I have knowledge about the arguments that people use when they say that tax cuts pay for themselves through increased economic activity. I may believe that those arguments are not accurate and that that statement is false, but nevertheless, I can understand those arguments. Or I understand that people write stories about dragons, and I could tell you about the properties of dragons, so that's knowledge. I do not believe that that dragons actually exist in the world.
So our knowledge is that large mass that we have that helps us construct the world. And so attitudes are part of our knowledge of where we stand relative to other people in society. Beliefs typically are in the knowledge bank as well, that refer to how it is we believe the world to function.
Anybody who is heavily involved in abortion debates knows the arguments that are used on both sides or on all sides of the abortion debate, but knowing the arguments that are used is not the same as understanding what a person's attitude is, which would tell you how they feel or which side they would be on. And so those things, so all three of those things can be different. We have been studying beliefs in our research, although there is a fair amount of research on attitude change. In fact, there's a lot more research, I think, on attitude change than there is on belief change, but we have been studying belief change.
Any brief comments on that before we move on? I think we've exhausted this topic to the point, but it is important to think about these different concepts and ideas. They're the key to moving forward in critical thinking. Well, one of my favorite expressions is keep your mind open, but not so open that your brains fall out. Now, a lot of people think that was Carl Sagan that said that, but it wasn't really him who said that. He used
that
term. Well, whose quote it was originally. Thank you for catching my, making me.
Who really said it?
More literally. Who really said it is a professor from Holyoke College, whose name is Walter Kutchnig. And it was back in 1939, and he used that expression in an address that he made to the Holyoke College students. Told them, keep your minds open, but not so open that your brains fall out. But Carl Sagan was very concerned about that same issue. And here's a quote from Carl Sagan from his book, a classic book, The Demon-Haunted World. It goes like this. The heart of science is an essential balance between two seemingly contradictory attitudes, an openness to new ideas, no matter how bizarre or counterintuitive, and the most ruthless skeptical scrutiny of all ideas, both old and new. So that whole idea is intriguing to me. And we had Susan Gerbic on last month. Mm-hmm. Who is
a gorilla
activist.
Skeptic.
Yeah, she's a gorilla skeptic, science supporter, and an activist skeptic. And one of the important things or interesting things to me in a couple of the shows, because we've had George Rob on too, who's another skeptic who wrote our theme song, and I asked him that question, the same question we were concerned with. What is skepticism to you? And so that's one of the things we're trying to get at. What is the relationship of skepticism to critical thinking. How do we tweak this dynamic between trying to be open-minded and having some semblance of
not being
standards.
A sucker.
Yeah, not being a sucker. Having some semblance or standard for evaluating the information that we're mm-hmm. taking in mm-hmm. without being so close-minded that, no, that could never happen, you know, that we're just, you know, how do we actually do that balance in a healthy way as a critical thinker?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's an everyday practice. It's something that we are, you have to be vigilant about. And again, it's a skill that once is sharpened, becomes easier. Once you pay attention to it, it becomes easier. I will never forget the time. Well, I forgot exactly when it happened, but I remember what happened. It was one of our shows. You know, I've always been under the understanding, because it feels so very true to me, that the holidays are a time of depression and suicidal ideation and that sort of thing. It's dark, it's winter, it's family, it's ugh.
And it makes so much intuitive sense.
It makes so much sense.
Yeah.
You know, but we had a caller that called up and said during one of our shows, that's not true. And I remember you and I kind of looked at each other and, you know, it's like, well, okay. I mean, we always thought it was true. I've never seen evidence one way or another. So there, I think we both had an open-mindedness that the caller was presenting something that was, in fact, potentially true, that went against our common understanding. And you went right home. You didn't wait any time. You know, I at least wanted to sleep on it and wait till tomorrow. But you went right to Uncle Google and you started looking it up. And it turns out to be true that depression and suicidal ideation is not really stronger in one time of the year or another.
Yeah. As evidenced by crisis intervention lines that take calls and emergency room visits from people who are suicidal or depressed. Yeah. Let's go back to the whole idea of what a skeptic's sniff test is. And then we're going to open the phone lines in a couple minutes here. Now, go back and read that claim that you had.
It's a headline.
Okay.
I brought a couple for you, but we're going to revisit the one from earlier.
Right.
A team of four Nigerian young women have created a generator that produces 6 hours of electricity using only a single liter of urine as fuel.
My skeptic's sniff test is based on, number one, does it violate any laws of physics or chemistry?
Well, you're the chemist.
And that doesn't violate laws of physics or chemistry. It's conceivable that that could happen. You know, even being a chemist, I don't have enough background in the particular energetics of urine to know or have some intuition as to whether there's enough chemical energy in there to produce the amount of electrical energy that they did. But in principle, it doesn't violate the laws of physics or chemistry.
So what I'm hearing is you're not writing it off. You're remaining open-minded.
Right.
That it doesn't violate any obvious rules that immediately kind of disqualify it.
Exactly.
I will tell you there's more information to understand what's going on here. It takes a little bit more information because I've never seen a generator that runs on urine. Have you?
I haven't, but it's conceivable. There's chemical energy in all substances.
Right, fuel cells. So there's a variety of fuel cells out there. Mm-hmm. You know, one of them uses one of the more common chemicals way up on the top of the periodic table of elements, hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
And hydrogen is found in our urine. So what actually took place here was these four young women in Nigeria, they used the urine. Was put into an electrolytic cell, which separates out the hydrogen from the urine. The hydrogen goes into a water filter for purification, which then gets pushed into a gas cylinder. The gas cylinder pushes the hydrogen into a cylinder of liquid borax, which is used to remove the moisture from the hydrogen gas. The purified hydrogen gas is then pushed into the generator.
Mm-hmm.
So this headline, a team of four Nigerian girls have created a generator that produces 6 hours of electricity using a single liter of urine as fuel, is completely true.
Mm-hmm.
it just omits quite a bit of information. And in fact, the process that they use requires more electricity to refine the hydrogen than is in fact produced by the generator.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's a net loss of energy. It's a conversion. You use energy to initiate a chemical process, which itself is able to create some energy, but not as much as you used to. Make the process work.
So yeah. Again, it is strictly true that they created a generator that produces six hours of electricity using only a single liter of urine. There were just many steps in between.
Exactly. That's why you got to check this stuff out. And that's why, you know, my first reaction was, let's go see a demonstration.
This did take place at a maker's fair, too. So I've been recently listening to this vlogger and writer called Hank Green. Mm-hmm. And he uses a term that it's just really grown on me in the last couple of months. He calls them head lies for two reasons. They are true facts that are only lies once they enter your head.
Yeah.
And because it sounds like headlines.
Yeah. And this is a head lie because it's true. Literally true, but when you research it and really get into the details, you'll find out that it's not saying what the inference of it might have been, that we're creating our energy by putting urine in. So that'll solve all our energy problems. Good.
You like
good
that?
Example. I do.
Why don't we open the phone lines
and then
I got another one for you.
Okay. I think we've talked about previous shows. Skepticism, skeptic sniff test.
Open-mindedness.
Open-mindedness, but not so much that you're believing every single thing, right? It's polite to be open-minded and listen to people. Where you store that information, which category, I have specific categories in my brain. Little rooms there. One is, I'm pretty sure this is true. Great amount of probability that's true. Laws of physics are
I assume that's a metaphor because you don't really have any room in your head. So 923-3911.
Yes.
I have a story here. Okay. I have multiple headlines from the same story, one that has recently come out. It's been really hot. It's been circulating the internet. Mm-hmm. Did you know horns are growing from young people's skulls because they use smartphones too much? Did you know that, Bob?
Yes, and it's true.
Yeah, it's well.
It's got
horns.
I wouldn't say
doesn't horns smell a little.
Yeah, horns. When you think of horns, you think of horns coming off the top of the head, and I think this article is referring to something else,
like bone spurs.
Exactly.
Yeah. So horns, bone spurs, kind of not the same thing. Kind of smells a little bit.
Well, it's just like the first headline. As you get, you know, the headline gives you one impression, but when. And it's not literally untrue. I mean, you could call bone spurs horns if you wanted to.
Sure.
You know, and they'd be made out of the same substance, you know, bone, one way or the other. Yeah, that's another good example of how we have to go beyond the headlines. And we had a show called Beyond the Headlines at one time.
Humans have started growing spikes in the back of their skulls. Phone use to blame, research suggests. So that was another version of the same article.
Mm-hmm.
Humans have started to grow spikes in the back of their skulls. Phone use is to blame, research suggests.
Mm-hmm.
So there's actually saying it's research. You know, it's clearly some researcher thinks our phones are to blame.
Yeah.
And, you know, they must be right.
How would you alter that headline to make it not misleading?
So the third headline I found.
Because it's still interesting, right?
It is.
It's an interesting aspect. If you're getting bone spurs from putting your head down and looking at your phone and the back of your skull is elongating, that's what's happening, I think, in this.
Mm-hmm.
And you're getting bone spurs in the back of your skull, that's pretty interesting in itself, whether you call them horns or not.
It is, but my visceral reaction is when my mother would say, if you keep making that face, your face is going to stay that way. How is it different? You know, we just want to blame smartphones for what kids are doing. You know, here's what nature.com, here's the headline they use in Scientific Reports when this came out in February 2018. prominent prominent exostosis projecting from the occipital squama more substantial and prevalent in young adult than older age groups.
Yeah.
So I can barely say it. I don't even know what they're talking about.
It's a mostly unpronounceable headline, but it's probably better headline.
I don't know my anatomy, so I don't know what this means. I see no mention of smartphones, although clearly young people, yeah. You know, that just goes without saying. And this is just an all-around uninteresting, unintriguing headline. I get it why, but the difference between horns are growing from young people's skulls.
Yeah, quite a wide spectrum there, isn't it? Those are great examples. I mean, it's a wide spectrum of going from one extreme to the other.
On something that is, once again, completely true, completely factual, it becomes a lie when it enters your head.
And you talked about some of the things your mother said. One of the things my mother said is moderation in all things. What I'd say to my mother is moderation in all things, including moderation.
Is that part of keeping open-minded?
Yeah.
And I'm also on Facebook if you want to send in a textual question. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's, you know, Bob and I, we're enjoying the 4th of July, Independence Day.
Let's see. We've pretty much covered the skeptic's sniff test. Do you have any other comments on other things that go into your skeptic's sniff test? In other words, do you have these little compartments in your brain like I have in mine? I have a, it's probably true. I have a probably bogus.
You know, for me, it's more of triggers. The little things trigger. Like these headlines stuck out to me because it's just, okay, like horns is a trigger. Why are we using horns? We know people aren't actually growing horns, you know? Mm-hmm. So why use that term instead of a term that is more specifically accurate? So for me, it's little things that set off a little intuitive skeptic inside of me that says,
And it like the first one, that the first headline that you did read, it made me actually want to go and investigate it a little further.
Because it's interesting.
To see, and it would have been interesting to come up with the idea that you did, that you got to go beyond the headlines. I mean, that is really an important point, I think, in critical thinking.
We're going more and more in that direction every day. And I will blame technology and social media and whatnot, because we've really become consumers of very small nuggets of content. And for me, really what makes the world around us so fascinating is understanding some more of the context and depth behind it. I like digging into things a little bit more. And, you know, I couldn't just let Red, White, and Blue settle on me on this day, Independence Day, 4th of July, you know, fireworks and stuff. Like, there's got to be more to it, right?
Yeah.
Like, just one day we were independent?
Yeah.
Do you know how we ended up at the 4th?
Go ahead and tell me.
So, and this is history. So in some ways there are facts, but it's not quite as cut and dry as, you know, maybe physics sometimes. Mm-hmm. But the Continental Congress came together in, what, 1774, 75, and they had to do it in secrecy because, of course, they were traitors. Mm-hmm. And the Declaration of Independence was, of course, a group project, and we know how fun committees can be. And so it took a number of days for them to agree on the language. And this is not in the time of the internet, when people, you know, physically had to ride their horses to come together and have a Continental Congress. And it took at least a few days for them to begin agreeing on the language. Mm-hmm. And the day that they finally, that committee came to an agreement was the 4th of July.
Hmm.
But in fact, it took many, many more months for all of the signers of the Declaration of Independence to physically get to that piece of paper and sign it. They didn't all sign on the 4th of July. They had to come from wherever, you know, under the cloak of night so the king didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just because July 4th, 1776 happened to be on the top of that piece of paper that we as Americans said, well, I guess today's the day. today's the day we declared our independence.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it just happened just like that.
And we thought there was something special that it goes back to.
Hello? We have a caller.
Hello, I can hear
cool.
you.
Cool. Yeah. Hi, caller. Okay. Welcome.
Are you
made it.
Getting a lot of calls right now or something?
Well, we were having some technical difficulties.
Technical difficulties.
Go ahead.
I think there might be some fireworks in the line.
Am I straight up on the air?
You are on the air.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was expecting to be screened. Okay.
Okay.
So I have a comment.
Uh-huh.
And I hope you can be open-minded about it.
Oh, we'll try.
I want to go back to the claims and beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the difference between claim and belief? Really quickly, as I know we're heading to the top. In my opinion, claim is, and I think I heard this, claim is when you have evidence, and belief is just based on feeling?
Well, claim is, the way we use claim is it crops up in critical thinking arguments in two places. One place is in the evidence. So a claim can be an evidence. Evidence are premises. So premises in an argument, in a critical thinking argument, need to be supported. You need to see, first, are they relevant? And second, are they true? So
okay.
a claim would have a truth value, and it would come into an argument having a positive truth value. You want your premises to be true.
Well, let me pose something to you then.
Yes.
I know we're heading to the top, and you're probably not going to have enough time to answer this, which is maybe perfect, but I believe that I have evidence, and I hope you're open-minded about this. I believe that I have evidence that the Earth is flat.
So do you have evidence or do you not have evidence?
I believe I have evidence.
But can you share that evidence?
Sure.
Well, the idea is, can you establish an argument that looks at all the evidence to make that belief an actual conclusion? Because you can have beliefs that aren't conclusions of arguments.
Well,
if you want to have a...
I get where our caller's going. Basically, I have evidence that mayonnaise is truly disgusting by the look on my face when I eat it.
So let's go back to that.
Oh, we're really getting into controversial topics tonight.
Yeah. Earlier, about 40 minutes ago, you kind of got me. I was going to call in, but you hadn't opened up the phone.
All right, Collie, you got one more minute then to defend mayonnaise.
Mayonnaise is not sent from hell. Come on now.
I have evidence that it was.
But do you believe you have evidence?
Well, this is just a good example of how complex normative kinds of arguments get. Value-based arguments.
Don't try and get out of this, Bob. I know you're a mayonnaise defender. I know it. You can't get around this.
Bob admitted you love mayonnaise. All right.
Here's what I believe. I believe that Julia said that she hates mayonnaise.
And I have evidence that it is factually awful when you watch my face when I eat it. All right, can we just settle that matter now?
That would be evidence.
Well, I think we're right at the top of the hour,
and
it's a good thing for that.
Thanks,
thank
caller.
Thank you, caller. So I hope you enjoyed this holiday version of Thinking Clearly with Bob and Julia, and we want to thank our engineer, Jackatron.
Thank you, Jackatron.
We want to thank our listeners very much for calling in or trying to call in. Sorry about the technical difficulties, and be with you in another month. Until then, keep thinking clearly.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, people-powered radio.